Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week, two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Jordy Bailey.
And I'm his hungover friend that smells like gingerbread, Duncan Nickel.
Duncan, I felt like this was a bit of a departure for us. You know, it's been a long time since we'd done one that was pretty straightforwardly a romance. You know, this one has extra part in it. If you read the blurb, you might actually be tricked into thinking this is a full-on mystery story. It's definitely not that, but I found this to be a nice, comfortable change of pace.
I very much agree. In fact, I'd been feeling like it'd been a while since we'd entered the kind of the romantasy subgenre, particularly considering, Geordie, I always thought of that as being like your niche to hold up on this podcast, because certainly isn't something that I had much experience with at all before we started doing this together. And it's been some time. I think we've done like three proper romantasies.
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely true. It was way more my niche when we started the podcast, or at least just before we started the podcast. The fact of the matter is, now about 50%, well, less than 50%, now about 45% of the reading I do is no longer dictated by me, so obviously I read less of the stuff that I choose to read, but on the whole, it's true that since I started doing the show, I don't read as many, you know, Jennifer Armentrout style books anymore.
Well, I'm glad we came back to it, because this has been a really good one. Today we are, of course, reviewing Paladin's Grace, the first in the Saints of Steel book series by the quite fantastic T. Kingfisher, who is not the author's name, as I discovered only about 30 minutes before starting this episode of recording.
I did know that. What I didn't know was that it was actually part of a series. I thought it was like, you know, there are some books out there where it's a series because there's a common, like, motif that goes between the books. I'm thinking of, like, the book Dungeons and Drama. It has a sequel. There are no connective tissues between them, aside from the fact that the main character of the first book shows up, unnamed, just hinted at, in one scene where neither of the characters between both of the books in the series are in their hometown. So it's like, blink and you miss it. They're sequels. But these are, actually, it turns out, and the books they seem to have the most in common with is the Bridgerton books.
Sorry?
Duncan, you're a big Bridgerton fan. You should know what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay. I didn't know this, but this is what I've just gleaned from your words. So the Bridgerton series, obviously, amazing. Netflix, great. Love to watch it. Apparently the books, a lot more iffy. But you follow like it's a romance series, but you follow a different one of like a group of siblings each book.
Yeah.
I'm going to say then, we meet a lot of paladins in this book.
Yes,
and I take
exactly.
It each one is a different... Oh, that's such a cool idea. Which is great,
apparently,
obviously, because I'm not going to lie, I was concerned that we were just going to get this couple breaking up if for the next bit. But like, oh, well, Stephen's got to get a new lover. Yeah. On we go.
I at a certain point, so the next couple of books are called, like, Paladin's Hope, Paladin's Some Other Virtue. And the idea is that I think they're supposed to be, like, the woman's name in each one, because the main female character in this book is called Grace, so it's Paladin's Grace. Aha, it's a play on words. I think the fourth book is called Paladin's Strength, so I'm assuming if the motif does persist beyond this book, it probably falls apart by the fourth book.
But I think we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves by reviewing Paladin's Grace just yet. Geordie, before we dive into it, good and proper, have you been reading, experiencing, watching anything else fantasy or non-fantasy that you want to share with us?
Well, first of all, so it has been like a month since I read this book, although the regular amount of time between episodes, but I have, in between the episodes, actually experienced a lot of fantasy stuff because I was really ahead of the curve. And so I went and saw the movie release of essentially the entire next season of Demon Slayer. The final act is broken down, I think, into two, maybe three movies. And I got to see the first one. And it's a whole season of anime just up on the big screen. I saw it in IMAX. So it kind of blew my brain out of my ears.
Oh, that sounds absolutely thrilling. How long was the film then?
Really long, like almost 3 hours. I genuinely at a certain point being like,
Jesus.
I was like, my word, this has no end. Because sometimes you know it's going to be broken up into a season later, because that's what they did with like the second season of a show. They released it in the cinema, and then it was 8 episodes. And at some point, you can feel like, yeah, I can tell that an episode has just ended here. And sometimes you're like, this feels like an actual movie I'm watching. How is this going to translate to being a TV show? Long story short of that, enjoyable, but it was like a good season of an anime. It wasn't like an amazing cinematic experience. So, sort of like concentrated fun, like binging on a really big screen. The more fantastical stuff I experienced was, I finally, Duncan, finally finished reading Elric and the Fortress of the Pearl.
At long last, you started this book, Geordie, what, 4 years ago? And I know you have bounced off it again and again and again.
Literally, we recorded episode 4 of the podcast. Hint, we're way over 50 episodes at this point. And after you read Elric of Monibone, if you have the collection, which I have, they say, now read Fortress of a Pearl, because that's what comes next chronologically. You shouldn't do that, because it's shit. I have been trying to read this probably about 6 times. I have tried to read this not long book. I bounced off it every time, but I finally did it. I finally made it through the, like, extended Inception dream sequence. Got to the end. And I gotta say, actually, the climax is pretty good. The conclusion's really good. It's just everything that leads up to it, which is just miserable.
Now, Geordie, I have read this book. I read it many a year ago. If I remember right, this book basically has an opening section which boils down to a guy travelling through the desert, and it's basically Tremors. They're like weird giant sandworm things that he fights. Then we get to this caravan of people, and then he goes into this like joint dream space, and everything just goes off the wall from there. It is like, as you said, it's Inception. Everything is sort of fluid in motion. I thought it was kind of a cool dreamscape, but it's not the most, how'd I say, narratively compelling.
I will say that I actually really skimmed the first half. Because this is my 6th attempt, I've read the first half a lot of times, so I did not go through the whole thing again. I kind of just started at a halfway point. I don't remember there being tremor worms. I remember there being a monster, but I'm pretty sure it was an above-ground demon. But yes, I reckon that Michael Moorcock had just learnt about, like, the sleep cycle, and I'm sure there's a lot of, like, deep meaning to the different stages of Elric's journey deeper into the unconscious that was really interesting to him, but is not interesting to me. I'm not against dream sequences in fantasy. We're going to have a really compelling Freudian journey into a mindscape in the future of Berserk, and it's going to be incredible when we do that in 6 years' time. But I really had to grind my teeth through this. But I made it through. I succeeded, and the last thing I read in between episodes, which was not a teeth-grinding experience, and in fact, flew by, I reread A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. This did not have to do with A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, like, TV show being, not announced, but, like, confirmed when it's releasing. I only found that out about a half hour after I'd finished it, but boy howdy, that's a great book.
Oh, it really is. I remember reading one of the short stories in like a collection of fantasy called Legend, like before I knew anything about Game of Thrones, and being like, this one's amazing. And when that first came out, I remember I had the hardback. It was at a time when I was like, oh, this is going to tide me over, you know, just that extra year I need for the next Game of Thrones book to come out. Wow, that was the times.
I regret this now, because I remember in my notes for the episode saying, make sure to get Duncan to promise not to say anything mean about the author before I bring up this short story. But I forgot to say that, and so the tradition has been fulfilled. Duncan, he just added 7 more days to the release of The Winds of Winter, so I hope you're happy.
I mean, what's that come to? An extra 0.01%?
you're being mean again, Duncan.
You're right. Let's let that one lie. It is a really nice collection of short stories. And in fact, it really actually, when I read it, thought, wow, George R. R. Martin can write short fiction really well. Maybe he should do more of this. I think in many respects, one of the upsetting things, the fact that we were waiting on Winds of Winter, he's just going to go, maybe he should just not bother and give us more Knights of the Seven Kingdoms.
I wouldn't be mad, to be honest. I know that some Game of Thrones fans would genuinely send him death threats if he released more Duncan Egg before he, before Winds of Winter. They would genuinely, maybe even murder him. But I would be really happy with that, because I enjoy this a lot more than I've enjoyed some Game of Thrones books, or Song of Ice and Fire books. But Duncan, that's the end of what I've been reading. How about you? What have you been up to?
Right, I've not been reading that much. Okay, is that bad? Am I uncultured? Because I haven't. I've stepped back. In fact,
you didn't read as much as me because you were reading this book, and I had already read this book. So you have an excuse.
That is true. But I've put a lot of hours recently and really reconnected with my love of video games.
Oh,
and I know. But it really got me thinking, because a lot of what the fantasy genre is and the zeitgeist around it comes from the influence of certain game franchises on modern culture. You know, I know Tolkien really redefined what an orc was, but the iconography of, say, the World of Warcraft orcs or the Warcraft orcs have had a massive influence. Warhammer, another case. I know that's originated as a board game, but my point kind of stands. It's hugely influential. Not that I've been playing them. I've been playing a game called Ease 8, Lacrimosa of Dana, which is a JRPG that originally came out on the PlayStation Vita 10 years ago. I'm with the times.
Okay.
And it just got me thinking, because this game, I got completely addicted to it. The premise of this game is that, and the point I'm trying to make here, by the way, is the fact that what you can get away in a video game in terms of premise and storytelling, which is just so freaking weird. And maybe it's the Japanese influence and I don't read enough manga, but to get that there are no, by those standards, it's normal. But this game, right, it starts out, you're shipwrecked on an island.
Sure.
Okay, cool. And you've got to find other castaways to make a little castaway village and explore the island and find a way off it. And for the first, like, 12 hours, that's the game. And I'm like, oh, I'm with it. And then you suddenly discover something later on. You realise, there are dinosaurs on this island. Okay, I've got you. I've seen that before. Not that weird.
Yeah.
And then you realise, there's a lost civilization that would, like, fall in ruins of an old civilization on the island.
Sure. Okay,
still with you. And then you start having dreams of another character in the past, and you're like, okay, they're from the last civilization. And then you find them in a stasis of, like, cocooned in, like, a tree, and you're like, okay, fine. Let's see where this goes next. And then, by the way, you're at, like, the 30-hour mark at this point, and then there's, like, 8 hours left to go, and you go from, like, we've just explored this island, found this person in a tree, to very quickly, the tree is actually a primordial god that brings about a stimulates evolution every couple of million years by bringing about a catastrophe that wipes out the dominant species on the planet. And the clock's ticked up now, so you need to beat out the spirits of all the races that have come before you, go into the tree, have a one-to-one fight with this creature that's meant to represent either God or the original sin. And then when you win the fight, you discover that the whole world is actually a dream by the goddess of the earth, and that she's decided, because you fought so well, she's just going to change the dream so that none of these events had to happen and the world's a better place.
Yeah, that all sounds pretty normal.
Well, it was to me. I'm like, how do these games go from, like, explore the island, keep it chill, and then before you know it, this sounds a lot with JRPGs. I know it's a bit of a trope. It's a sort of, you start out rescuing a cat and you end up having a fist fight with God.
Oh yeah, Final Fantasy, Persona. Is that
all the time? I've played a few Final Fantasies. I'd really like the Dragon Quest series. Chrono Trigger as well, but like mm-hmm. maybe I'm not in tune with like the wider JRPG space. But it's just like, what other mode or medium can you put out a story where it's like, okay, we're going to do, it's going to be in the last 10% of my novel, or 20%, I'm going to escalate things from grounded real world scenario right up to right we're fighting the gods of the universe.
I would agree with you that that sounds like something that could only happen in a video game, but I truly have read some really bad sci-fi books where pretty much that exact thing happens, so I'm afraid I can't follow you on that one.
But yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's got me into playing some games a bit more. But that is it for me. I think we need to come back now to Paladin's Grace.
I will say one more thing, Duncan, that when you were going through that list of things, like, isn't this so weird? In my head, I was just being like, this just sounds like a Godzilla movie. Like, this is like ancient civilizations, like reincarnated spirits, a magic tree that houses like a parasitic body. I'm like, yeah, this is just like a Godzilla movie.
Well, it's not like the one with Bryan Cranston. I give you have to say that.
Yes, I will say that. Nor like the one with Lisa Simpson in it. Okay. Paladin's Grace.
So now, this was a nice... Now, at the end of our last episode...
Okay, you go ahead, Dunk.
At the end of our last episode, Geordie, you basically gave away your thoughts on this book. You came out quite hard and were like, this is one of the best things we've read this year. We even commented that like maybe this year hasn't been the strongest. A comment that I did go back over our episodes and kind of felt pretty validated by. I think like Watership Down was the last like, oh my god, I can't believe I've experienced this book. Now, having read Paladin's Grace myself, I don't know if this book necessarily blew me away or changed my perspective on literature, but it did lots of very fundamental things very well and just presented a romance in a way that I don't think we've had before on the podcast. And that alone was so refreshing and so nice and wholesome that I kind of fell in love with this book.
Yeah, refreshing is the word. And Duncan, I'm actually in the same boat as you. I do think my comments last time probably were actually a little bit hyperbolic. Definitely some recency bias there. And the recency bias has naturally developed. Because I read this book now like a month ago, it's not really that fresh in my head anymore. And to be frank, I remember more details of like, I don't know, Warbreaker than I remember of this book, even though this is a much better book than Warbreaker. It hasn't really stuck with me, despite the fact I did really enjoy myself reading it. I think there are a couple of good reasons for that.
And I can certainly have a good guess of what they might be. Paladin's Grace, just to give a nice overview for people who haven't read the book, is a romance. It is a romance between a paladin who's part of an order whose god died. No one in the world really understands how this happened, but the magical guiding power of their deity just ceased to be, and this broke them. They've now taken refuge in this new temple with this new sect of the rat, and they're just trying to find where they fit in the world. The other kind of key character is Grace, a perfumer who has come to a new town to kind of have a fresh start for her life and establish herself and her business. And these are paladin called Stephen and Grace, through a series of mishaps, meet, instantly have the hots for each other, and little by little accidentally get embroiled in a case of regicide, general murder, potentially necromancy, and the politicking of this sort of city-state that they exist in.
That was a good summary, Dunk.
Thanks.
This book sort of walks a line between, like many romanticy stories, it walks the line between being a pretty straightforward, sweet, will-they-won't-they romance. Both Steve and Grace need to get over personal damage and let down their guard in order to be with each other. There's a point where it gets a little steamy, and you have the satisfaction of, yes, they did it. They've committed to each other, and they're doing it. That's great. And the other side of it is the adventure. You you're seeing this couple get together, and one of the obstacles that stands in their way is not merely their own emotional complacency, it's not merely their own emotional damage, it's the circumstances that surround them. The situation's just too dangerous to do it, or it's too complicated, or they're literally being separated by forces beyond their control. But that's only kind of true for this. The conspiracy kicks off when the two of them are witness to a poisoning, a potential assassination attempt against their regent, and subsequently they both start getting involved in the investigation. Stephen, because the White Rat says, you are a witness to it, you're a man of action, we trust you to look into this, even though you're not technically one of our guys, we're together in this now. And Grace is embroiled in this because her best friend and landlady, who was also a witness to the poisoning, happens to be a super spy for a neighbouring city-state.
That's not a plot reveal, by the way. That is just a kind of opening descriptor to the character.
So I'm going to jump in there, step away from like the source of drama in a book, and just talk about humour. Because this book doesn't really like... Actually, that's not true. There are lots of attempts at jokes, but it's more sort of passively funny. The way in which Marguerite's identity as a spy is laid out is done in this straightforward, as you like it, throw it out their way. Like, she genuinely doesn't think it's a big deal to reveal her secret identity to a woman she hardly knows. It's the spontaneity of it and the no-sell delivery. It's compelling.
It's the kind of... Well, I find it's a lot of it is kind of this general just subversion of expectation. And your general expectation is a character is a spy, there's certain preconceived notions or characterization or tropes, you know, linking to that. And this is a subversion of them. It's instead of hiding their identity, they're very forward with it. A similar thing I think is done with the character of Stephen. Stephen's this big muscular paladin, walks about in armour all the time. What's his hobby? It's knitting socks.
Yeah. There's a deliberate sort of unshackling of our characters from drama. You know, the book has a pretty... Despite the fact there's a lot of actual danger present in the text, it's very blasé. You know, it takes a gentle stance towards violence and danger. It disarms Stephen by giving him a typically feminine hobby, and his personal struggles with his feelings towards Grace get made fun of by his mates.
It almost can kind of just be taken up by the fact that it doesn't take these certain aspects too seriously. You know, it's not kind of wallowing in its own kind of melodrama. And this gives the whole thing quite a clean-cut, brisk freshness of we're not going to dwell on the points that we feel loads of other authors would traditionally dwell on. We're going to skip over them and give some rather different moments the time in the limelight.
Well, actually,
that was my takeaway.
I think you're hinting at something that is true about the text, but I feel like you have said something that is frankly not true about the book, because what you've made it sound like is it's not repetitious. And if I was to point out a flaw with the book, it is that it is repetitious. A lot of ideas get repeated again and again and again. Like, Stephen's reasons for doubts about whether his relationship with Grace would work out, they don't change throughout the book. They aren't challenged and they don't develop. At a certain point, he just pushes past those fears, because it's a do-or-die situation. Well, I just gotta tell her how I feel because we may not be alive tomorrow. But there's a lot of him going, I can't be with her because I'm a super holy barbarian and I might lose control at any time. And there's a lot of Grace saying, he wouldn't be interested in me anyway because I'm a big old wet fish.
But I think that kind of speaks more to the fact that there's kind of two novels going on here. I think the general fantasy adventure plot, I stand by my previous comments, but the romance plot is handled in a very different way. And you said there's a lot of repetition, and you clearly drew attention to the fact that they both have a lot of introspection. These are two characters, what they think about themselves, and why it's a problem for them to be together, despite the fact they clearly have the hots for each other, and there's no real issue for them to overcome, at least on the onset. Geordie, can I just actually talk about this romance? Because sure. I really liked how this was different to a lot of other romances that we've covered.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the romance we've covered, and tell me you think I'm being unfair, but I feel like starting at Twilight, touching mm-hmm. on it in Daughter of Smoke and Bone,
mm-hmm.
definitely in A Court of Thorns and Roses, there's this kind of position where you have the single protagonist and they are slightly outside to the fantastical. And then you have the other figure, the one who's a bit more mysterious, the one who has the magic. And it's about them coming to understand the other. And then the romance blossoming and the elements of danger and what they find attractive and a bit of love hates thrown in there just for good measure.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this story, I think, does a really nice job putting both Grace and Stephen, one, on fairly level footing. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like there's really that much of a power imbalance in this relationship. But you get straight from the off, they like each other. We know this as a fact because we continuously jump from their two perspectives. They both like each other. They both have their own reasons why not to. And it's almost farcical, the early goings of them just misreading each other and thinking, oh God, I said that. Oh, he must think I am such a fool. And then Stephen going, oh my God, she was so sexy when she did that. This plays out again a lot, but throughout the first like third. And I thought it was brilliantly different to see, I don't know, maybe this is just a relationship that I look at and can be like, this feels more true to my lived experience. Oh, is that too telling? Than the previous example.
I do understand what you're saying, and I definitely agree. I think there's two things that really separate this from other romances which we've looked up to at this point. There's one I feel like is very obvious, but I'm going to stay on the one which, you know, you've brought up, which is that, yes, this isn't a Bella Swan situation. This isn't a Daughter of Smoke and Bone. No one is being introduced to the fantastical world for the first time. This one is very different from that because it's about two mature people meeting in the middle. And that's the other big difference. These two characters are not teenagers. Every other character we mentioned up to this point was a teenager, you know, between, what, 15 and 18 years old. Well, these two are probably, like, 37 years old.
Do you know what? That hadn't even really clicked with me, but you're right. And it's actually quite nice that they both have, I don't know, certain priorities. For like, they're not trying to find who they are as much. That's not an element to this sort of relationship.
They're both trying to move forward. Each of them have had a life. Each of them has had a previous life which has fallen apart. Stephen hasn't lost his faith, per se. His faith has left him. You know, he's almost destitute. His life has been shattered. It's sort of like if he had, you know, lost his job and his house and his dog and everything about his life had changed without him choosing to do so. Grace is at the other end. She chose to leave her previous life, but it's left her scars on her. She has an ex-husband, a very negligent, abusive husband, who has left these mental scars on her that make her unwilling or unable to move on with her life and to progress. Both of them need to take a step forward towards a new life, and both of them need to find the pathway to do that. That makes it compelling. The fact that their romance ties up with them developing, healing, going onwards as people means there's a lot of drama baked into will they, won't they?
Because it's not just about them, will they, won't they be together. It's will they, won't they let that past trauma get in the way, stop them achieving the happiness that they clearly both want.
All right. We got distracted from the drama of the book, the conspiracy. Now, Duncan, I will say I do think the conspiracy is probably the weaker part of the book. Part of that is probably because I did not realize that this was the first book in a series. Again, I at the start was like, this is going to be like probably all in the same world, but not necessarily the same like plot. It's not going to be a grand quest. Maybe it is, actually. Maybe it is, like, over the next five books, there's going to be little hints of, little hints of stuff developing book to book. I will say, I'm pretty sure that didn't happen in Bridgerton. I don't think anyone, there was like, they weren't hunting down serial killers in Bridgerton.
No, but something that I think is worth drawing attention to, although this is the first in a book series, the Paladins of Steel book series, this is actually the fourth book in the world of the White Rat. The White Rat being the good religious sect, as it were, in this universe. There was three previous novels, a duology and a standalone. So I get a great sense that a lot of the wider political mechanisms going on in this fantasy land are just kind of meant to slowly tick forward. It's not really ever going to be like, this is the crunch point of the novel.
That's interesting. I knew that it was connected to her previous books. It didn't really occur to me until this moment that I might be missing like really important context and data required to understand the story.
I did a little bit of a recce about this fact, and far as I can tell, no, this story, you do not need any of the prior context to dive into this story. I've looked up the immediately preceding book. I believe it's called Sword Art.
Okay.
Apparently the author was set out to write a sequel, got distracted with the idea of a perfumer, and then dived off to the left. But all I can tell, the only kind of continuous factors from that novel is the religious sect of the White Rat, the religious sect of the Motherhood, who are the sort of villainous religious sect in this world, and apparently the lawyer that appears in the courtroom scene later on is the only crossover character. Apparently he also has to represent some characters in that book in an equally out of his depth fashion.
Well, that's good. I like that character. So the fact that that's the one character who's like jumps between books amuses me. Almost like that one guy who apparently always shows up in Brandon Sanderson books on different planets, except I don't care enough to learn his name.
I would really want to critique you here, but to be honest, I can't remember his name either. He's the guy that tells stories in a funny, funny way.
Oh, funny?
But yes, we have a lawyer that does a similar thing.
I don't remember that character.
I don't remember
that character being funny, Duncan.
You interesting, quirky.
Wait. Hang on. Actually, I legitimately just put something together for the first time. I've only read two Brandon Sanderson stories. I read Warbreaker and White Sands. And I just realized that dude's magical power is controlling sand, right?
Yes.
Does that mean that he's from White Sands? Like, that's the story he originates in? Because those people control sand in White Sands.
Julie, I'm not here to offer these answers because I do not have them. But you're definitely going to be reading Mistborn at some point, so prepare yourself.
Yeah.
I will convert you.
Alright, whatever. Speaking of conversion, the Paladins of the Saint of Steel now have been taken in by the White Rat, because the White Rat's priests are all goody two-shoes, and their main drama is obviously that they're displaced, their god has died somehow. But what I want to hone in on is purely their magical power. You know, it wasn't obvious to me, as the story's going on, like, what does magic actually look like in this book? Because the only power which the Paladins of the Saint of Steel obviously seem to have is this berserker rage. And I actually really like the way this is handled in the book. I think this was genuinely a really great way of handling Steve's insecurity. And whilst I did think it was repetitious, it is a great barrier to him being in a relationship with Grace. Because this isn't something which I can go, oh, just get over yourself. Get over your pride, Mr. Darcy. Get over your prejudice, Elizabeth. Go on. No, genuinely, it's like, oh yeah, if he does snap, which these paladins have been known to do, well, he could genuinely kill her. And that's terrifying. And we're flirting with a genuinely dangerous relationship. You know, this is a story about a woman who's been in a previously abusive marriage. Is it about a woman bouncing into another potentially abusive relationship?
It certainly kind of leaves this great level of ambiguity throughout pretty much 90% of the novel. All we're really given in the early stages is that this berserker rage is implied to be this kind of tide that rises within Stephen and the other paladins. And it's made very clear that once it comes over them, they effectively black out. And they just had faith that their god would guide them in the correct use of their insane rage and increase human strength. And then basically they would come to after the fight and just be like, cool, that happened. Did we win? Thumbs up.
What?
So they don't know how their rage is going to work in this godless world.
And just to be a little bit more clear, since then they have broken into rages, but other paladins of the Saint of Steel have always been around to corral them with their own prodigious strength. So they do know these rages still kick off in a less controlled manner. And so this makes a natural barrier. And at a certain point within the story, and actually no, there are two really significant points in the story where Stephen's rage does play a prominent factor. There's a scene in the courtroom where Grace's ex-abusive, negligent husband shows up to be on the stand against her. We haven't actually gone to that point yet, but yes, she gets arrested. And Steve is so angry that he menacingly approaches the bench and is like, I'm going to strangle him. And then at the last minute pulls himself back and doesn't strangle a man to death in a courtroom, which is a bad move, legally speaking.
I think also it's quite important to cover in relation to Stephen's character that although this rage is linked to his own personal anger, there's still a lower level of it's part of an other. There's some magical element. Could we mention, like, he basically gets super strength at some point when he's in this mode. It's not just a guy getting angry. There is something, it's almost like Bruce Banner hulking out.
Yeah.
You know, he gets so kind of angry to a certain level, and then the Hulk comes in and takes over.
And it's more like the Hulk, or certain iterations of the Hulk, than you might think, because later on, he does give in to the rage, because he gets attacked in jail, he has to defend himself, and then from there, everything cascades out of control, because once the rage is in charge, it's like, alright, now pure instinct is leading the way, so the superego has logged off, he gets attacked by a monster, kills it with his bare hand, bends the bars to escape, overpowers the guards, breaks into a different prison, frees Grace, defeats several guards, and then, after he's done all of this, it turns out that entering a barbarian rage, one, makes you very sleepy, and makes you a little stupid.
Yes, there's a scene when he's trying to leave, and Grace is saying it's like she has to guide him round objects, in fear he'll start picking a fight with a random barrel.
And one, funny scene, I enjoyed it, I had a good chuckle. Two, actually a very smart move on TK, I always said, called her TK Ingfisher. Good move on Kingfisher's part, because it really draws back. You're feeling anxiety of, oh my god, he's berserk, he's out of control, is Grace going to be in danger? Oh no, she's not, and in fact, we are taking away tension from the scene by making it actually a little bit silly. You know, just poke fun at it, you know, he's become dopey.
It certainly kind of leads off, obviously, Stephen has his own concerns around the rage, but as we kind of see it play out in this scene, you do really get the sense that it just means that he becomes very single-minded. You know, in his head, he still loves Grace and wants what's best for her. Unfortunately, as we kind of inferred, the Hulk's in control now, and his conclusion there is, well, I want her to get out of prison, so I shall smash in the doors and break her out.
Right. But this is the last and most significant thing, because this has to tie back to Steven's flaw is not that he has barbarian powers. That's not a real human flaw. Nobody on Earth actually has that. The actual flaw is cowardice. It's the fear of commitment. It's the fear of moving forward in his own life, because, which actually gets unpacked really well in that same no sell, disarming, just play it straight style, which a lot of the book has. Someone says, look, Stephen, let's actually look at your big rampage, all right? You, like, gave a couple of guards an owie. One guy is going to be out for a couple of weeks. You should apologize to him. You damaged a rain barrel and you bent some bars. Nobody actually died. Your losing control is genuinely less violent than what a lot of people do on purpose. You have made a bit of a mountain out of a molehill because you're afraid.
It's a really nice scene. Firstly, I really like the fact that his fellow paladins are really good at kind of like talking to him about these issues.
Mm.
I really enjoyed these scenes, you know, to give perspective. And they really do unpack the fact that we mentioned earlier, when people have gone into a rage in the past, the other paladins would come in, you know, and restrain them. And so he sees these people as his safety net. Mm. He's like, I can't go, I can't start a relationship with someone else. I need to stay where I am. This is where I belong. I can't move forward from living, you know, with sort of my bunkmates, as it were. And I love the scene where they put that in perspective. There's a very similar scene where someone kind of goes to him, what's your long-term plan? You know, do you ever want to meet someone? Or do you want to just live here forever? What do you actually want? Mm. And he has to face that and go, well, no, I don't want to just be lonely forever. And he's like, great. So go and make this relationship work. Mm. Come on, shoo-shoo.
We focus on Stephen a lot. Let's move on over to Grace. Why is she reticent to jump into her next relationship? She doesn't have barbarian powers. She's just really good at sniffing things.
So Grace, our perfumer, is, as you kind of illustrated at the start of this episode, it's made myself the complete kind of inverse of what Stephen. Stephen had a very happy life of rages and fighting.
No, he,
and brotherhood
he didn't.
That got torn around him.
Well, his mum died of tuberculosis and he grew up in poverty. And he was like a soldier fighting demons for years. But yes, he had a more stable, satisfying life.
Grace, on the other hand, she has started out, again, from poverty. She was effectively sold to this perfumer master to teach her a trade.
Yeah, and he's extremely abusive. Like, he starts off fine, and then he's clearly, like, begins to deteriorate. He's this old man. He starts off teaching her his tricks of the trade, everything he knows about perfumery, and then at a certain point, he goes crazy paranoid, and he starts threatening her, and he starts saying, like, giving these genuinely horrible threats about, like, pouring mercury down her throat and things like that. And I really like the way in which this is, again, the blasé, tell-it-like-it-is style of the book really works with the way Grace thinks about this. And the way Grace talks about this and relates to this formative experience. In the scene where she tells Stephen about this for the first time, she, like, there's a moment where she, like, waits for him to laugh, and then he doesn't, and then she goes, oh, I guess that's not as funny as I remember it being, which is really familiar to anyone who's ever spoken to someone who's come out of an abusive relationship. That's a classic experience of, like, you know, someone talking about their parent being, well, you know, let's not get deep into that, but that's a very familiar experience you have talking to survivors. And beyond that, the fact that she gets bounced from her abusive master to her new, not owner, but the guy who, like, buys her license to do perfumery is the man who then immediately becomes her husband, Philip. And this is another familiar story, because it's all about someone who, on the outside, doesn't seem to be anything wrong with Philip. You know, he picks her up, he does her a great favor, right? But then abusive qualities start to come into it.
This is very hard to read about, particularly in the fact that it's a very subversive or slightly more subtle abusive relationship. Actually threw my mind back to when we read Wormless Kings.
Yes.
obviously not as subtly and horrific as that, but the fact that it starts out of this person who presents themselves, they're not going in and being actively violent towards her. We see, however, that they're in this constant cycle of putting her down. You know, any problem is her fault.
Mm.
Any idea of theirs that goes wrong, it's because of her. This is particularly, I found, very kind of, I don't know, cold chill up my spine scene, where it talks about them in the married bed and their sexual relationship. And he takes out, you know, him not being a very good or considerate partner in sex, and he just blames it on her.
Yeah.
I'm obviously a master at having sex. This is clearly your fault. You're the one who is frigid or not engaged or not doing enough.
And what I think is compelling and strong about this part of the story is the fact that it isn't... I wanted to pick my words carefully because I was about to say over the top, but that would be the wrong thing to say. It's not. It wouldn't be over the top to have him be physically abusive, because obviously physically abusive relationships exist. The fact that it is a subtle approach to abuse and to neglect, I feel like there's a level of sophistication to that. It would be the easy path would be to have that she's in fear because she's being hit. She describes at one point they had this huge argument, and there's a moment where she thinks she's going to be hit. And that's obviously harrowing for her. I feel like Kingfisher is playing a gentler approach by having it be his words and his actions and his gaslighting. And I'm using that word properly, not in the like altered sense of just lying, but no, actual gaslighting of, you're wrong to remember that. You remember it incorrectly. It's ridiculous that you would think about it that way.
And this plays a much more subtle game into her future relationships. I really kind of have so much respect to skip over that kind of, or take a different direction or different approach to the violence, because that's Stephen's fear. Stephen is terrified that the rage will come on and he'll act in a violent way. Whereas Grace has a different kind of concern. One, obviously she has this very low opinion of herself, but also she is terrified of being in feeling indebted
yes.
to a person again, who is then just going to take advantage of or make her still small.
Mm.
It happened with her old master. She felt indebted for him because he saved her from the orphanage. She felt indebted to her ex-husband, Philip, because he saved her from his old master, from her old master. And now she's got this issue with Stephen the Paladin,
mm-hmm.
because like, great, another person think he's just walking into my life after I've, you know, rescued myself from my last abusive relationship, and they're going to play the rescue again.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to just come in, act like my hero, and then have an expectation on me to simply be grateful.
Yeah, I think that was an extremely good barrier to her entering into relationships. It's a really great reason for her to have her doubts. It's a really good reason for her to be stuck in an emotional rut and be unable to move on. You might be getting the sense that I think that Grace's problems are a little bit more compelling than Stephen's. And it's only because of the final delivery on Stephen's Barbarian Rangers not really being that big of a deal and that being kind of funny that I think it even remotely comes close or parallels.
I think the key difference there is that Stephen, although we get this strong repetition of it's about his, you know, his rages, his concerns about that, the real issue is Stephen's fear is leaving his current status quo, because he doesn't want to leave his old life. He's kind of being forced out of it and having to find a new life. That's what's holding him back. The rages are more just his excuse, whereas Grace has this much more subtle, layered kind of problems around trusting kind of anyone and building just relationships in general. Unlike Stephen, who has the Church of the White Rat, who has his fellow paladins, the ones that are left around him, it's just Grace and her best friend, who's also her landlady. That is her world, and her pet Tab, who is a great little creature.
He's fine.
He's not a cat, but is in every personality driven way.
Yeah, when I looked up the like art, I'm gonna actually sidebar, when I first found out about this book, I saw this really nice cover art. I was like, oh, this just looks good. Like, it's a really nice illustration. I'm interested in reading this book. Whenever I go to look for it now, hideous. Really boring, really blank, just vague art. It's just like a dark background and some colours, and maybe a sword. And I'm like, there's nothing about this that makes me want to read the book. It's the exact same thing that happened with the Legend and Lattes series, where you have these beautiful illustrations, and then you replace them with just garbage. I got distracted.
No. That's a really good point there, Geordie. I know it's a bit off topic. Firstly, Legends and Lattes, because I think the old ones used to have the characters on them, filled with personality, and now it's very much this sort of just general mood board of coffee-related iconography.
I'll say one more thing on that front. The insult to injury is that if you then open the front page, on the inside, you will find the old cover, but printed in smudgy grayscale. Every time I see that book in Forbidden Planet, and I'm with my girlfriend, I open it up, I turn the page open, I hold it up and I say, look at what they took from you.
But, sorry, we're not just going to dump off this straight away, though, because there is a point with Paladin's Grace. When you first suggested this book, and I had never heard of this before, I never heard of the author before, but I looked at the cover that I was looking at on Borrowbox or my library website by T. Kingfisher, and it's this old style image of the paladin and Grace in a dark road, and Grace is just opening her door a little bit. And I looked at it, and genuinely, Geordie, genuinely, I thought this was something out of the 1980s. Instead of some cutting bit of romanticy, just the way this book was sold to me, and the title of as well, I don't know, something about like Paladin's Grace just sounds like Paladin's Sword or Paladin's Virtue or whatever. And any other word, that's probably one of the books in the series, to be honest. I thought we were doing something very 80s classic.
Yeah, you're thinking of like Fabio era romance novel, where it's a semi-shirtless man on the cover with a buxom lady by his side. Right there, the main appeal, the couple placed at center stage, a sort of style of cover which genuinely does not exist anymore. It's all sad, moody boys with... There's a book that's come out recently. It's called like Silver Stream, Silver Tear or something. And I hate the book cover so much because it is just a pretty boy who does look a lot like one of the Bridgerton brothers, to follow a theme, but he's got a tear running down his face, and they've made it like a glittery, it's like a glittery tear, it's shiny, it's silver, and I can't stand it. It feels like a parody of a book cover.
All I will say is that I will take any of the book covers mentioned thus far over the standard sword, just that, the number of just covers sword that I've seen, and it's just the sword, and just not even the whole sword, it's like the top of the sword and the hilt. I'm like, what? This tells me nothing other than you are valiant. Why?
Firing shots at Joe Abercrombie here. Alright, so, the whole thing I was going to say is, on that particular old cover of this book, Tab appears and he looks horrible. And he's not what I imagined a weasel cat to look like. My image in my head of a weasel cat is much cuter. That's literally all I meant to bring up.
True to that. Geordie, shall we get in to the actual murder mystery plot and let that carry us towards the final conclusion?
Nah.
How does this get going? What kick... Nah. What do you mean, nah?
I'm joking,
this is like
but...
a good part of the book.
There isn't much to it.
No, it's not as interesting.
So here's the deal, right? There's actually two separate... Well, hang on. I'm about to get ahead of myself. There are what appears to be two separate plots going on at the same time. The first thing, long before the political intrigue gets added, Stephen is escorting a doctor around town because someone is out there just beheading people. No one knows why. There's a random serial killer just killing people and leaves behind only a head. What's the deal with that? And then later down the line, Stephen and Grace happen to both be at a royal engagement. She's presenting the, like... Oh, God, what is he? Is he a...
Visiting prince.
All right, hang on. Let me get this right. there's a prince of another city-state who's visiting, but their city-state is headed up by the Archon. That's it, the Archon.
What does that mean, Geordi?
Oh, an Archon? That's like a, I'm pretty sure that's a type of angel.
Cool.
Okay, I'm just noting myself here. So, turns out Archon is like just an ancient Greek word that means ruler. The reason I associate with angels is because I am a big nerd. The idea of Archons as like important semi-angelic beings comes from Gnosticism of all things. So, yeah. I accidentally did Gnostic angelology. Oops.
But she's presenting a gift to the prince of another city-state who's visiting, and there's a botched assassination attempt. A young man, apparently in the service of the motherhood, the evil, but somehow tolerated religious sect, shows up, screws up his assassination attempt, eats a like poisoned tooth, and dies. And the mystery, whilst it is not a major part of the book, there is actually a promising start. I actually really like the way in which the mystery begins. There's a tense negotiation between Stephen and this young, desperate man, which goes poorly. He dies. And then the first part of the investigation, where they're gathering clues, they're putting their heads together, Marguerite secures an investigation of a corpse with the coroner. Those are actually really good scenes.
They are, and firstly, fun little side character, the coroner, I think their name was Piper. Just nice to have, I don't know what it was, this side character, barely in it, contributed some key plot details in terms of progressing the investigation, but just got across so much personality in their short time on stage. Same with the lawyer later on. I really hope this is one of those like recurring characters that we can let like Stephen like gracefully, pun intended, move to the background.
Wah, wah.
And keep these kind of quirky, funny characters, you know, just popping in on them. Really enjoyed this. One thing that
I agree. I'm really glad you brought it up, because I was going to let it slide, but something that really works about the scene is that whilst it's in one way purely a fact-finding mission, they go there and they get an important clue. The guy who died had been poisoned twice. He'd drunk poison, yes, but he'd actually already been poisoned. And so, whoever had ordered this assassin clearly didn't value him as an asset, and maybe didn't even care if he succeeded or not. Ooh, isn't that a useful clue? But it takes one extra step. It goes one step beyond that, because there's a genuinely really great dynamic between all the characters in this scene. The body on the table currently being opened is a woman who's died in childbirth, and we learn so much about all the characters in this scene with how they talk about it and what they don't say about it. Right at the end of this scene, Grace, who's been a bit quiet at this point, asked the coroner, this woman died in childbirth of tuberculosis, did the baby make it? And a coroner says, oh yes, she delivered a healthy baby. And Stephen, who's the perspective character of the scene, observes a lot. He notices this like this wave of relief that falls over Marguerite. And hey, we just learned something important about Marguerite. And he also expresses internal gratitude for the coroner for the noble lie he's just told. And that scene itself is just like, that really stood out to me of, okay, that was just really good, efficient storytelling. That was compelling. That was strong.
It's so nice when you get an author that you just want to kind of just give them a gold star for that precise scene. It's like, you have mastered getting across lots of information effectively, efficiently. Just well done. I know your characters better.
Unfortunately, in terms of getting across information, that's the end of the, like, good parts of the investigation and the mystery.
That is very true. This plot kind of then gets left a little bit on the wayside as we spend more time, obviously, exploring Grace and Stephen's relationship until we get to sort of the midway point of them falling in love. We have a scene where they go out to some trees. I think Grace is collecting moss for perfumes. And we have that kind of, you know, they can't quite get together yet. So there's a spark of tension. But, oh, they can't, one of them can't overcome their personal issues just yet. So Stephen messes it up a bit. He recoils. Grace and her insecurity takes it the worst way possible. It all falls apart. You're like, okay, well, now we're into the next act. I hope they patch it back together.
Yeah, the misunderstanding, the important halfway point of a romance, yeah.
And then, as Grace goes stomping off, she steps on another severed head. I'd almost forgot this plot existed at this point. I'm like, great, we're back on the murder trail. This is cool. Unrelated to the poisoner, as far as I'm aware. We've got some severed heads going.
Well, that's the problem. That's the problem. So are these two... Apparently, you have this story, like, it's not clear to me, what does the beheading have to do with the poisoning? Because obviously there are these two mysteries up in the air. How are these two things connected? Well, the problem is, by the end of this book, all evidence says they're not even slightly connected. In fact, they are so unconnected that it genuinely feels weird that the characters aren't trying to join these dots. In the story, Stephen gets arrested because, you know, he got mad in the courtroom and the bailiffs don't like that. He gets put in jail, and whilst in jail, he gets attacked by one of these, by the monster, or rather, one of the monsters that's doing the beheadings. And it was so obvious to me that the motherhood is behind these murders, and that in order to stop Stephen getting too close to the truth, they had planted this monster there in the jail in order to kill him. No character ever suspects this because they come up with another explanation. And it's reasonable that, yeah, these things genuinely might not be connected. The bodies are actually never resolved. That's clearly a problem that's going to persist into the future books. It just feels weird that no one is like, these must have something to do with each other, right? Two really strange circumstances happening at the same time to the same people. But no one questions this.
I found several kind of little holes here. Firstly, you're right, the creature in the cell. No one drills down into that. No one's like, well, what guard put it there? Who was giving the orders? The motherhood, the evil cult, is not grilled nearly enough. I know the idea is that, oh, well, they have influence over the regency, so we can't push them too hard. I'm like, guys, they're so obviously evil. What is your long-term game plan? Also, this really bothered me, okay? So they never find the bodies of the people who they were beheaded. And we learn that that's because the bodies are being used in this necromantic fashion to make these monsters. Question, why not just take the head with you? Because you know what? Then no one would have any idea that anything was even blooming going on. No one notices half these people are going missing. They only notice when a severed head shows up.
Yeah, I mean, right now we don't know what the clay-headed... I'm going to assume they're, like, golems? Like, that's brought up as a possibility. And that was my theory. Because golems are mentioned a couple of times as, like, a potentially dangerous type of magic. We don't know why they exist. We don't know what their plans are. So maybe there's a really good reason that they wouldn't care if the severed heads were found. But yes, it did cross my mind. Like, surely you could just bring a burlap sack with you when you're swapping bodies and just put it in a bag and then throw it away somewhere. Put it in the river.
Certainly has just something at the back of my head. I'm like, this, they don't seem like the villains. In fact, I would generally say a lot of the villains in both plot lines are agonizingly obvious. From a mystery setup, the moment that we're given any little feelers or hints, I'm like, yep, spot them, they're bad. Point in case, going back over to the poison regent plot line, so there's attempted poisoning, and then a little bit later on, Grace is approached because the prince is attempted to be poisoned. Then later on, Grace is approached by the prince's valet, manservant, guy, who's like, he really loved that perfume. They want to put an order in. Can you come and do it? And she does it. And then a little while after that, guards rock up and go, you have poisoned the prince with your perfume. off to jail with you. And it's just, this bit of the novel had me going back and forth. Because the jumping and leapfrogging that, like, the motherhood are doing to, like, be like, she did it, based on truly, truly no evidence. The fact that their only evidence is that they steal Grace's notebooks and find one that has the things that talk of poisons. Grace is like, that's nothing, that's just a curiosity. And I'm like, How did you know she had that notebook? How did you know that was needed to be stolen? What would your plan have been if you couldn't have stolen it? The guy who, like...
Well, I mean, you're sort of going backwards from that. You know, they sneak in, they check. Can we find anything that can be used against her? Oh, we can. Okay, let's use it then. If they'd snuck in and found nothing could be used against her, then they wouldn't have pinned it on her.
Okay, maybe that is a fair point. And then this valet bloke called De Valier. Is that what we call it? De Valier?
De Valier.
He is the most obviously evil guy I have seen since...
It's true.
I can't even think since. The cast of Black Company. He comes into this and Stephen doesn't like him because he's all, you know, putting the moves on Grace. He's like, would you like to come out for lunch with me? Tell me about yourself. And he's meant to be this, like, I don't know, counterpoint to, like, Stephen's affection because he's forward and he's sophisticated, where Stephen is, you know, reserved and a bit more brutish. And I don't know, it's just like, maybe it's so agonizing obvious in the questions he asks and the overt attention he shows and how he goes out of his way for Grace. I'm like, this isn't just a signpost. This is a neon electric light show pointing to this guy's crookedness and evil. Like, is that a problem? Maybe not. But it just took me out of things a little bit.
Right. So there's a conflict here. Not as in a narrative conflict. There's a problem within the story, a contradiction of tone. On one hand, this is sort of a mystery, right? We're trying to get to the bottom of who ordered this assassination. The other side of it is that this book sort of becomes a courtroom drama. And actually, sometimes in the courtroom drama, you don't want there to be a mystery. You actually want it to be really obvious who the bad guy is, because that elevates the frustration of the wrong party being accused. So watch any courtroom movie where the hero is the defense attorney. Obvious innocence of the defendant in your eyes as the viewer makes it more dramatic and more frustrating to see justice not being done. And it makes the hero, if the hero is the lawyer, more triumphant when they come through and win the day. So, but what we're experiencing as we see this really obviously bad case being brought against Grace is we're like, oh, this is so frustrating, I hate these guys. We're feeling that on purpose. That's what being designed or being intentionally fed. But it undermines the mystery. When it becomes really obvious who the bad guys are, then, well, that detracts from the courtroom drama, detracts from the mystery, and the mystery undermines the courtroom drama. There is one thing about this that I think works surprisingly well.
Oh, yes?
And genuinely at the end, I was like, oh, I really didn't think that you were going to pull that off. Because the whole time through, I'm like, what does the motherhood get out of this? Why are they so set on getting Grace in? Like, they don't belong to this foreign kingdom. Why are they acting as its agents? I don't understand. And actually, I was really pleased by the explanation. I genuinely felt like it elevated the story.
Oh no, I like really like this as well, because this has been like the obviously evil cult in like through and through. They are always being dickheads. They're always being anti our protagonists. And in general, Fred, you're like, why does anyone tolerate these asses? But I really like this big reveal, because what we get is we kind of get this sort of drawing back of the curtain and look, this is the information they had at the time. They thought, oh no, a prince of a foreign land is about to be poisoned in our city. For the sake of our city-state, we need to pick a crazed lone agent and completely blame them. One person takes the fall, they die, yep. There is no war or further political fallout.
Exactly. They go from being like a cult of crazed maniacs to being like a rogue agency. You know, this is like the CIA blaming an innocent person. Evil and reprehensible, but it does make sense. Like, you're like, okay, I understand why you're doing this. It's not out of control and deranged. Yeah. The explanation I felt is actually like, oh yeah, these are like reasonable people. They're not crazy. They're evil, but they're not crazy.
In fact, I really like at the end, there's a standoff near the end of the novel, which we will go in more detail in a second. But one of these religious zealots is there, and he's yelling at these guardsmen to be like, shoot at them with the crossbows, take them down. And the guardsmen are all like, you don't have a right of execution, we can't just murder them in the street. And this character is just there to kind of play up tension. So when we get this reveal of like the logical power behind the sect, I believe one of the paladins, it might even be Stephen, kind of brings up, what about that guy who literally was trying to get us all shot? And the bishop, Beartongue, who's one of the White Rats group, is just like, oh yes, no, he's been demoted for over-zealotry. So it's just that kind of, I don't know, bureaucracy sense of even the evil sector like, no, we can't just shoot them in broad daylight. That's not how this works. Bad man, go and sit in the corner.
You just remind me about how, okay, you said we're going to talk about the climax of the book. So let's move on to that. Stephen gets arrested for being mad in court. Everything's looking really bad for Grace. Everything has turned against her. Her ex-husband has shown up and has ruined her character. Stephen is supposed to be a character witness, and he got arrested, so he can't do that. And the last person to show up to be her characteristic is Marguerite. And Marguerite doesn't show up in court, which on one hand is like, oh, how dramatic. You know, the one person she thought she could rely on didn't show up, but also is like, it's so obvious that it's just because Marguerite is saving the day that it's like, maybe it's on purpose, maybe it's dramatic irony, and you're not even supposed to think for a moment she's going to show up. Anyhow, not the worst thing in the world, but it's so frustratingly obvious for you, like, oh, come on, don't waste my time with this. And actually, I will just say one more thing, which is that Marguerite solves too much of this story. Like, she solves the mystery off page, she resolves the issues of the prince off page, she, like, tells the authorities about what to do off page. That's just a bit too much, you know?
No, I do quite agree. It kind of robs our characters of any real agency in bringing this all to a close. And that's until Grievy said the whole climax when you kind of look at it. So after we get the prison break, as we've kind of gone over in a very weird order, we haven't quite tackled this chronologically this time. Sorry if you're confused. Yeah. Read the novel and you will then understand.
That's a good point, Duncan.
Stephen and Grace are prepping to flee, and Grace takes Stephen to this like near desolate churchyard with a little chapel in the middle, and this is where they're going to hold out while Stephen gets his head together. And we have really the climax of, I keep using the word climax because it's on my mind in this scene, of their internal issues being resolved and them coming together. We get a really good moment.
They bone!
Yes, they do. And you know what? This is a pretty darn well-written sex scene. I really like this.
I liked it too. You know, everyone has a personal barometer for how steamy they like their sex scene. This was like a real bullseye in terms of it is hot. Like, it's all about the passion of the moment. There's lots of bumping and grinding and like gentle whimpers, but it isn't full on like erotica, which sometimes just goes over the top a little too far for like my personal tastes in a sexy book. This hit the sweet spot for me.
And what I think the key to that is, at no point do these people feel like they transition out from being their characters. This is still Stephen and Grace as we have known them. There's some really kind of great moments here, still talking about their insecurities. Obviously, we know Stephen's a big buff paladin. We're just getting a description now without all the armor in the way. There's an amazing moment, I felt, that really, really brought both Grace's insecurities to the forefront and showed how Stephen is such a different character to the absolute dickhead of an ex-husband she had. When Stephen goes to...
Yes, Duncan?
When Stephen goes to do oral on Grace, and she doesn't like this. It's not what she enjoys in sex. And this brings up a lot of bad memories about her and her ex-husband Philip, of how he used to, and there's this horrific description right on the book, like, laugh at her, something like a dog or... And it was, yeah, there he goes. And how, you know, she didn't enjoy that, and he used to get very aggressive about this, how, you know, can you not enjoy it? I included in the best thing. And so she says this to him, she's like, oh, no, I don't like that. And then you get this really kind of short few sentences about her kind of bracing for his reaction.
Mm.
And all Stephen says is, oh, all right then. Are you still enjoying this? And she goes, oh, yes. And he goes, okay. And then they kind of move on. And I'm just like, oh. That moment, linking it back to, like, the previous characterization, but showing where Stephen is as a character and keeping the sort of sexting going, but also keeping it, from my perspective, a bit more grounded. You know, they're not psychic. This isn't a sex scene for the observer's enjoyment, because I think that's where kind of the erotic steps in. Yes, okay.
But what you're getting at, Duncan, is that it's not the Fabio romance book. Stephen isn't presented as, like, the god of sex. It's a clumsy, sweet, but steamy scene between people who are just sort of fumbling together, you know? It doesn't feel like this world-shattering, completely redefining event. It's cute, it's hot, but it's also sincere and vulnerable.
I don't know. Thank you, Geordie, because I think you've said that so much more succinctly and stopped me rambling into what I'm saying, things that I really probably didn't want to be saying. So
that's okay.
Yes.
Tell us more about the oral sex.
No more. Moving on. So we have this great scene. And we also have this great scene kind of afterwards when Stephen has rolled over, he's fallen asleep, and Grace has this moment of thinking, okay, do I leave now? This is my time, you know, if I'm just looking after myself, it's like last time, I walked out on my own and sought a better life for me, I can do it again. I can leave Stephen now, I can leave this all behind me and start afresh. And we get Grace's kind of decision, no, I want to be here with Stephen, I'm going to potentially risk, you know, the problems of being a wanted criminal to be with Stephen and to face it together. And that's a nice little moment for her character.
Absolutely. As you would hope in a romance story, the culmination of their relationship is also the culmination of their arcs. Stephen is able to realize that he's not completely out of control, and he's able to, like, to express passion towards her without fear, and she's able to become vulnerable. And then, the next day, I'm not gonna lie, this is just, like, a funny scene to begin with. In a way that this could be interpreted as an insult, but I promise you it's not. It feels like a scene in, like, a fan fiction. It feels like a scene where you have the side characters show up, not taking the scene seriously. Again, it has this blasé, no-sell quality to the writing, where they show up, they're making fun of Stephen and Grace, and just making a tense scene funny. And it gets more tense when the bad guys show up at the same time. But all of Stephen's paladin friends show up and be like, well, it wasn't hard to track you down. You weren't exactly subtle, were you?
No, and I really like their kind of confidence in the whole scenario. It kind of robs the scene of its sort of self-importance. But at the same time, I think it also takes away... I personally takes away the tension, like that's a good thing. But it just makes the whole thing a bit more relaxed. You're like, no, I'm reading a nice story. I don't have to worry. I know there are courtrooms and murders and these weird half-golem, half-corpse monsters. But I'm not reading an unpleasant book. I'm reading a nice book. And while these paladins are around, I can trust it's going to still turn out to be nice. Also, Stephen asks the guy to turn around. So they're up in the loft space. His friend comes up. And Stephen's like, what the hell? You can't watch us get dressed. Turn around. And the guy just goes, I'm standing on a ladder, mate.
That's right.
That's a good line. I loved it.
The word we're looking for is bathos. The opposite of pathos. It's where a scene of high tension is undermined. The tension is removed from it, often by humour.
It worked for this scene.
It does work.
The scope and nature of the story being told. We then get into...
Right, yeah, because this isn't a real political thriller. It's like a little political thriller with a romance story. And how much of the pie chart you want to be romance, and how much you want to be thriller, and how much you want it to be mystery is going to depend on you. Because personally, I feel like the pie chart isn't quite right for me. I want there to be more mystery in this.
I surprisingly wanted more courtroom drama, because we haven't mentioned him enough. But that flipping... her defense attorney in this... That guy was hilarious. They're her lawyer. Loved the man. More of that
name's
character.
Zale.
Zale, the property lawyer.
Oh, and I completely forgot. It's not him, because Zale is like... Oh, it's always... they always use they, them. So I think they're supposed to be non-binary.
Oh, apologies. They are great. Anyway, back to this climax. Everyone rocks up. Everyone shows up for a fight. You got the Motherhood's evil religious sect. You got the guards with their crossbows. You've got the Bishop of the White Rat, who's like... Guys, I know what you're all about. Can you please not cause a scene? Being a bit of a motherly figure to these boisterous paladins. Loved it. And everyone's standing off. Everyone's about to show down in a fight. The paladins about to do their thing. And I love the fact that Grace and the Bishop, Bertung, they both kind of just like have to... They're like, right, everyone stop. And this is a nice little descriptor where they go to like push their way through the paladins. Can't and have to walk around the edge of this like seven people shield wall. Thought that was fun too, but you're thinking, right, how are the characters going to resolve this? How are they going to work it all out? What's going to be the big reveal? Who's going to have the eureka moment? And then unfortunately, as Jordy alluded to, they don't really get it. A carriage comes rolling down the street and out pops the prince who was being poisoned.
Well, I want to stop you there for one moment, Duncan, because you're right, and we should get to that, but I'm going to point out one thing before this, which is that Duvalier, the villain of the story, is there, and they've elevated the charges. It's no longer attempted murder, now it's murder. The prince is dead! Bum, bum, bum! So you have to kill her now, because now it's murder, not attempted murder. This is legitimately the stupidest thing in the entire book. It makes no sense.
Oh, well, considering that he hadn't confirmed the prince was dead, and also the guards were pretty clear that, like, no, we're going to take them in, like, you don't have a right of execution, there's still a law.
You have to prove it. Yeah, there's no escalation of attempted murder versus murder. They still have to prove it in court. So there's no reason for him to tell this lie. It doesn't change anything. All it does is it makes it... Because you can always prove attempted murder. Or you can always, like, say, I have a reason to suspect attempted murder. You can't say, she murdered that guy. You don't know that he's dead.
I can't tell if he's meant to, like, just trying to gull the guards into firing their crossbows. Which also, at this point, I'm like, dude, can you not read the room? Even if they fire off with the crossbows... Like, these paladins are mopping the floor. If anything, you don't want them to kick off. Because you'll probably just die.
I mean, he literally doesn't care about that. He just needs Grace to die and take the fall. Because it's his neck on the line. Someone has to take the blame. And if Grace is dead, she'll take the blame and he'll get off scot-free.
Yeah, but you know what? Say she didn't take the blame. Say the prince died. He, the loyal compatriot, says it was the perfumer. The courts of the foreign land go, nah, we're not going to prosecute them. And you go back home. You're still just in scenario B. Like, his job was to get his friend to become the new crown prince. That would still happen. And then if Grace doesn't take the fall, then you still just say, well, they're still guilty. You're just protecting your citizen.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I guess the end of the day is that that's true. The problem is that he gets caught.
Yes, because the prince isn't dead. Oh no, in a very kind of veterinary from Discworld feeling move, he noticed that he was being poisoned immediately and then sent everyone out of his rooms and only had his most loyal guards and drank naught but water that he got himself and fruit he peeled himself. And he's been secretly waiting to see how this all played out. Okay, well done. I don't know you as a character. That seems quite smart.
No, it's really underwhelming. Because what the crazy thing is that the obvious thing to do is Marguerite walks in. The character we've spent so much of this book with. She has to be the one. If she's going to solve the problem off screen, have her be the one to show up and say it. Because it's satisfying to see one of our heroes save the day. It's not satisfying to learn she did it off page and that some guy just shows up and then resolves all the conflict. That's boring. And the reason Marguerite can't show up is that there's this grand revelation that Marguerite is not called Marguerite. That she is a spy from a foreign power who has replaced another spy from a foreign power. There was a spy called Marguerite from another city-state. She's dead and she's been replaced by an imposter. An imposter replaced an imposter.
I did not care.
It's true. It was fine. It was fine. I guess it makes sense that you have Marguerite be so cavalier about her secret identity because, well, I was about to say because she wants to save her friend. She was already pretty cavalier about it before Grace was in trouble. Like, she told Stephen, she knew that Stephen was going to tell the White Rat, so evidently she kind of knew she was going to bounce. Anyway, it was, yeah.
Yeah, the ending gets resolved. Obviously, if the prince isn't murdered, then Grace is off the hook. Obviously, they caught out the Valier bloke because he described the symptoms of the poison, despite the fact the prince never developed them, so he gets caught. And the evil sect, although rather annoyed and flustered, realise no dead prince, no foul, and go home. And then we just transition to our two lovebirds, working out what mm-hmm. their life is going to be. No, sorry, that's not true. We're actually undermining the sort of the second climax, which is Grace's moment, which is her ex-husband
yes.
rocks up at her shop in, like, not quite the epilogue, second last chapter, I think. Maybe it's the epilogue. And this is actually a really great moment, and I don't want to spend too much time, but again, this is really good writing by Kingfisher, because we get a lot established that Grace's shop is her home, it's her safe space. She always locks the door and she feels secure. Mm-hmm. That's already been challenged when they broke in to take, like, evidence against her. But now Philip's there, and I really like the fact that she comes out, she's going to confront Philip, Stephen comes out, and she has this whole moment of like, oh, what's Stephen going to do? Is he going to, like, batter him? But Stephen just kind of leans against the wall and she's like, okay, he's got my back if things turn ugly, but this is my moment. I don't need rescuing. She verbally dresses down Philip, tell him to get lost. It's really nice for her to still get, like, her climax with her. In fact, if anything, it's better than the last climax because yes. it actually matters.
Yes, I mean, it is, definitely. It advances the character, it progresses her story, it brings her to her the culmination of her character arc. She has grown, she has triumphed, and in its own way, this is even more of a power fantasy than Stephen being an indomitable, not killing machine, because he doesn't kill anyone, but butt-kicking machine. She gets to stand up to her abuser. She gets to win. And more than that, she gets to say to him, like, not only am I better than you because I've succeeded here, I was the only reason you were success before, which gets completely proven true because she says to him, the last thing that is exchanged between them is she says, go home, I'll be sending divorce papers to the shop. And Philip says, don't bother, I lost the shop 2 years ago. And then he leaves. It's the last thing he'll ever say to her is, as close as you will ever come to saying, you're right, I needed you and I fucked up. And he's gone.
I always feel bad that I almost skipped over this moment because it is so much more powerful. In fact, I'll be honest, the relationship with Grace and Philip was sort of the bits of the book that got me most riled up. When he first appears in the courtroom, I genuinely felt angry. I'm like, how dare you come into my story? You are not part of Grace's story anymore. So this is
I did
really
feel
nice
a lot of
see.
Dread being like, oh, when's he going to show up? Because you know he's going to.
Just at the worst moment.
We have to say one final thing about that final scene, Grace's big climax. Because you mentioned, you know, Steve leans against the door and he stands back and, you know, he lets her have her moment. And all of that is true. But the real reason is, and I do like that this is just a thing that persists through a little bit of Kings of a Wild energy. He is not as young as he used to be, and in this moment, after they've had love, had a little bit more steamy sex, Stephen has pulled his back. And he can't go and beat the shit out of Philip. He has to stand back and be like, I really hope I don't need to beat him up, because right now I physically cannot do it.
Which is a nice reminder of their age. I don't know why, it's just that kind of cute little element of like, these are not heroic figures of the fantasy tale. It just felt a little bit humanising to me. And there's lots of little moments that I felt were very humanising.
I agree. But I will also say that, Duncan, you will regret that specific line when we are on season 12 of this podcast and you are Stephen's age. it's a nice reminder of his decrepit 30-year-old's age. Oh, these poor, withered creatures.
Well, that may one day be so.
I literally have a bad back right now from falling out of bed, so I might be feeling a little bit sensitive about this.
Don't worry, Geordie. One day that will be us. I fear it, yet I know it is the inevitable. What is also inevitable is us moving on to a new book. But before we do, Geordie, do you recommend Paladin's Grace? And if so, who to?
Yeah, we should wrap it up. I do think it's incredibly crazy that we have not talked about scent in this book.
If you must.
So I will do it super fast. The reason why Grace makes a great perfumery is that she has an amazing sense of smell. And there's a big emphasis in all of her chapters about her thinking about smells like a nerd. She thinks about scents, she thinks about different oils, she thinks about how different ways to make perfume, about how you'd refine different scents into a new perfume. And it's interesting. You know, it works because, one, you really get the sense of, oh yeah, this character is living out their trade. This is not a type of career I'm used to seeing in my fantasy novel, so it's novel. And also, you know, as a writing exercise, scent is it's a sense that's hard to pull into writing. You know, we're often told in our writing classes, use all five senses. But if anything's getting left behind, it's probably the sense of smell. Fantasy authors love to have their male lead smell of pine or other things that it's impossible for a normal human body to smell like, because we are attracted to our partner's scents, but we're actually attracted to the like dirty, musky smells. We're not attracted to the nice smells which you'd find in a perfume stand. Which does lead to one very fair criticism I've seen, which is that, my God, Duncan, did you know that Stephen smells of gingerbread? I think it was mentioned once or twice.
Once, twice, 200 times. The only saving grace I give to this is that we do discover it's not his just natural sexy aroma. It's specifically a body rub that the paladins yes. use. And they even bring up her point near the end. They go, yeah, there is a better body rub, but that made with turmeric. And yeah, no, it's not fun. I was like, cool. He's not just one.
I like that too. It was an awareness of genre, which I found useful. Yeah, so good use of an underused sense. Good job, Kingfisher. Do I recommend this book? Ooh. A little tricky, because the answer is yes, I really like this book. I've had a lot of fun talking to you about it, Duncan, and that has reignited some of my passion for it. Because, as I said at the start, I actually didn't really remember much of this book. I had a good time, but not everything left an impression on me. So I have to mollify my recommendation. And I am also going to say, I think part of the reason why you and I, Duncan, like this book a lot is the novelty of it. Because one, we haven't read that much romanticy on this podcast. We're getting closer and closer to doing 100 episodes. And a vast minority of those are romanticy. Part of what's also novel about it is the characters' ages. These aren't teenagers in love. These are approaching middle-aged people in love, who are at a point in their life where they're moving on to a new stage after having grown up, after having either their first loves, because that's not true for this book, but the first passions of their life are over and done with. The fact that this is also new to me is probably why I'm really find it appealing. I can definitely see if you have experienced similar stories to this before, this might not really be the one for you. In much the same way as The Bonesmith to me was like just one too many almost identical, very straightforward YA fantasy adventures, I can definitely see this being yet another romanticy middle of the road book if you're really used to this sort of thing. 'Tis new to me, O Brave New World, but there's a good chance you, the listener, may have seen this story before. And if that's the case, the flaws in this book, like the mystery, like the disappointing climax, have a good chance of holding it back. If you only read books about teenagers falling in love, definitely give this one a try. Fresh, new, I like that a lot. If you're used to middle-aged people falling in love, less so. Less so recommendation for you.
My recommendation obviously runs along a very similar track. I think we're very much agreed on this novel. This is a book that I enjoyed. It's not up there with the greats. I'm not going to stand it next to Watership Down and go, it is a masterpiece. But I also fully enjoyed my time with it. I found its overall length and the rate of which I kind of flow through the pages to make it not overly much of an investment. So I wasn't expecting as much back out of it. And I think a similar way to my opinion on The Bonesmith differed quite strongly from Geordie. I'm kind of saying, you know what, this is a good example of what this book sets out to be. If you have liked hearing about it, chances are you will like reading it. And coming off Georgie's recommendation, if you do read a lot of like romanticies of the more Corn, Thorns and Roses and Twilight end of the spectrum and want something a little bit different, this is a perfectly fine and enjoyable book to give a go.
Apologies if anyone heard on my microphone the sound of a shout of frustration. I think my girlfriend might be playing Silk Song next door.
See, video games, mate. Maybe we need to do an episode around them. But not today.
That is not what the podcast is about. That will never happen. Unless, I guess, it's like a book adaptation of a video game. I guess we could do the Legend of Zelda manga. No, we're not doing that. Okay, next time, Duncan. Despite the fact that it's my episode now, because of the weird structure of the podcast, it is my pick. However, I actually still don't know what we're going to read next time, because this is the last episode coming in September, which means it's time for our October Book Club.
That, right, it is again. The autumn months have come, the leaves are falling from the trees. How are we going to get the creep on together? Traditionally, we've had a long-standing history of looking at Berserk around this time of year. Will we do the same? Will we do something different?
I'm genuinely asking you that question now, Duncan, because I know what my first pick for a new book, which we have not covered before, is. But will we do... We will do Berserk. Are we doing that first, or are we doing my pick first?
Let's do your pick first, Geordie. Let's have a little bit more fresh blood on this podcast.
Well chosen. I wanted to do this book last year. I can't remember why I didn't do it, but I've been meaning to read it for ages because I've seen it adapted as a movie. I've seen it adapted as a stage play. I've even listened to like the first part of a radio play, but I've never actually experienced it as it was intended to be read. As a book.
I'm excited now. I'm trying to think what it could be, but unless it's you dragging us back to some proper classics of horror?
I would call it a classic.
Is this some Dracula-style stuff?
No, because I've definitely read Dracula.
That is completely true. I don't know. What could this be?
Something I think has been missing. We haven't had the pants scared off us yet. It's been a long time since we actually had a scary book, and this one is supposed to be scary. I've chosen The Woman in Black.
Okay. Let's do it. I'm going to be scared.
Classic ghost story, written in the 80s, which surprised me. I had the impression that it was written earlier than that, but I guess it does make sense. It's just about, you know, it's a Victorian age book, but I thought it was like from the 40s or something. No, from the 80s. And I'm looking forward to it. I've seen it adapted before. I didn't think I could get scared by a stage play, but whoa, I genuinely had so many frights in the theatre.
Okay, I'm going to have to big myself up to this. Horror is not my forte.
You're a brave boy, Duncan.
I'll try to be, Geordie. I'll try. But that is next time. Until then, if you've been listening and you have experienced any of Kim Fisher's works, maybe not just Paladin Grace, maybe some of their works. I know they've written a lot of children's books. Maybe you're just a fan. Like, I have a quick glance at their list of works on Wikipedia. There were many, many. You know, if this is your favourite author, tell us where else to go. If you've read forward in the Paladin books, tell us what do you think of them. And if you just want to drop an opinion on anything else that we have covered or yet to cover on the podcast, the best place, as always, is our Instagram, It's Just Fantasy Podcast. A longer message can always be done on our Gmail, itsjustfantasypodcast@gmail.com. And you can always catch us up on Blue Sky at Just Fantasy.
If you enjoyed the episode, you can please leave us a review on your platform of choice. And don't forget that a lot of platforms now offer comments. So if you want to leave us a comment on something like Spotify, please go ahead and do so.
We read them all. We share them all. Let us know your thoughts.
Until next time, I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol.
Goodbye! I'm getting spooky. I'm getting spooky, Duncan.
Till next time.